Today's podcast is brought to you by Gamefly.com. Sign up for a premium free 30-day one-game-out trial specifically for Picture Lock listeners at GameflyOffer.com/PictureLock. You're listening to WERALP Arlington 96.7 FM. Welcome to another episode of the world-famous, award-winning Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, filmmaker, film festival director, Washington, D.C. area film critic, and lover of film and TV. Picture Lock is a film review show in which we'll take an in-depth look at new releases, classic films, and I'll speak to filmmakers, critics, actors, actresses, and everyone in between on a national and local level. You can find all the back episodes and so much more at PictureLockShow.com. Today I'm talking to Patty North, executive director of the Alexandria Film Festival. The festival has kicked off this weekend, and you can be in attendance to see films from local filmmakers and beyond from November 10th through 13th. I'll also talk with Josh Zeman, the producer and director of the docuseries The Killing Season. You can catch this new series that follows the Gilgo serial killer mystery and airs this Saturday on A&E at 9 p.m. Finally, the new documentary, The Eagle Huntress, hits theaters this weekend. I have the director, Otto Bell, and stars of the film, Aishalpan, and her father, Alkali, on to talk about making the beautiful documentary about the first female eagle hunter in Kazakh tradition. That's all ahead on Picture Lock.
Hi, this is Andy Edmonds, director of the Virginia Film Office, and you're listening to Picture Lock.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. And the Alexandria Film Festival takes place November 10th through 13th this year. I've been supporting the Alexandria Film Festival since its seventh year. And if you go to youtube.com/picturelockshow, you can find some of the older interviews that I've had with my next guest. She's the chair of the festival now in its 10th year. Patty North, welcome back to Picture Lock.
Thank you, Kevin. Delighted to be with you.
It's our annual chat. But for the radio audience, I'd love for you to just let them know, when did you first fall in love with film?
Oh, gosh, when I was a kid. I grew up in Burlington, Vermont, and we had a local theater that was walking distance, and they had a matinee every Saturday, and I was there every Saturday. And I have an older sister and a younger brother, and my younger brother would start to fuss after the kids' show, and my sister took him home while I stayed there. So, I mean, I've loved movies ever since. I've done a little bit of screenwriting. And when I was working on the Alexandria Commission for the Arts, you know, I got an opportunity to do something that we hadn't done before, which is digital art. And so the film festival was born.
All right. So if you could just give us a little history, how did you get involved with the Alexandria Film Festival?
Well, as I said, I was on the Alexandria Commission for the Arts, and I began to notice that, you know, two things were happening. There were really world-class filmmakers working right in Alexandria, and it was all kind of occurring under the radar of the Arts Commission, whose mission is to promote the arts in Alexandria. So I put it on the agenda several times. You know, we really need to get, ahead of the digital explosion that's happening and be a part of it. And so they sort of like, okay, Patty, you do it. And so that's how the film festival got started. And then probably about 5 years ago, we, for a variety of reasons, decided that we would take it independent. So we are now supported by the city through the arts grant system, but we're an independent 501c3.
Okay, awesome. You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, and I'm talking with the chair of the Alexandria Film Festival. The festival will be taking place November 10th through 13th in Alexandria, Virginia. All right, Patty, so what can we expect to see this year? I know you have different showcases, so maybe you could talk about that.
Sure. Well, why don't we start at the beginning with opening night. Thursday night, November 10th, on Market Square in front of City Hall, we'll be doing a free film. It's called Nighthawks on the Blue Highway. And it's about a blues band that was born locally, but has played all over the U.S. and internationally as well. And it has been in existence for more than 40 years now. So it has quite an interesting history, you know, from the 70s, and they still play a gig every, you know, few days, mostly on the East Coast, but all over the U.S. So that's about a little over an hour. And that will be followed by a performance by the Nighthawks. So I think that'll be fun. And it's all free. It's our gift to the city, our thanks to the city for supporting us for 10 years. And it's just going to be a big party, even popcorn.
So that's going to be outdoors.
That's outdoors.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Pray for Indian summer. Although we have found that typically, you know, it's still early November, and it's, you know, this is the third time we've done an outdoor feature on Market Square. So we have found it's, you know, you might want a hot toddy, but otherwise it's reasonably comfortable.
Okay.
And by the time the Nighthawks play, we'll all be dancing, so it doesn't matter.
Right, exactly.
Going on from there, we Friday all day, we have a whole roster of, again, 100% free films. And there's some really interesting things that I think people will enjoy. And if they go to our website, alexfilmfest.com, they'll find the entire schedule. And then we move to Hoffman AMC on Saturday and Sunday. And we've got, you know, a variety of features and shorts, some of which will be, you know, that's Veterans Day weekend. So mm-hmm. some of it will be celebrating our veterans. We have a film, for example, called Charlie and Sam. And, you know, less than 5% of our World War II veterans are still living. So this honors a World War II naval aviator named Charlie Edwards, who's 97 years old, and he will be with us.
Oh, wow.
So I think that'll be fun.
Yeah.
And there's another film called A Salute to Honor that's also reflecting on World War II veterans. So, you know, really be a tip of the hat to it being Veterans Day weekend.
Yeah.
And then we have a couple things that sort of focus a little bit on the what will have just passed the election. a film called American Moderate, where this young woman who's going to vote for the first time is trying to decide who she's going to vote for. And she's getting a lot of influence, shall we say, and trying to make up her own mind. So there'll be a couple of nods to the just passed election. We also we have a wonderful kind of coming of age film called Girl Flu that's really funny. I think people will enjoy that. Rosenwald is by a local but pretty much nationally celebrated filmmaker named Aviva Kempner. And mm-hmm. it's about a philanthropist who was one of the founders of Sears Roebuck, who establishes schools all over the U.S. for African Americans during the Jim Crow period. And his name is Rosenwald, and he's a Jewish guy who took very to heart to the notion of service, and it's his story, and it's a very inspiring story. For a completely different turn, have you ever heard of a guy named Travis Walton?
No.
Well, I think I may have heard of it, but I had forgotten it. But back in the 70s, there was a group of young men who were construction workers who came out of the woods with one of them missing and told the amazing story that aliens had abducted one of their friends. And obviously, this was, you know, looked at very skeptically, to put it mildly. But mm-hmm. all of these men were given polygraph tests, and all of them passed. And wow. the one who was gone was returned. And he himself had a story of being abducted. So this is a story that has never been disproven. And in fact, you know, as I said, has had some objective confirmation in the sense of, like, how would these, you know, young men, I think the oldest one was 22, would have all passed a polygraph test over this rather remarkable story. So it's returning to that story and telling it in greater detail and talking to those men who now, that was 40 years ago, and they, you know, they maintain the veracity of their claims.
And what day is this?
That is Saturday at 1 o'clock.
That sounds really interesting. That's something that I wouldn't mind going to check out myself.
Well, great. We'd love to have you.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with the chair of the Alexandria Film Festival, which takes place November 10th through 13th in Alexandria, Virginia. Patty, let me let you get back to it. What other great films do you have in store for us?
Well, and we have a foodie showcase, we're calling it.
You're killing me.
a film called 50 Years of Farming for Love and Vegetables. Another one called The Culture of Collards, about, collards and how that has a special place in culture. Another film called Food Frontiers, where you have, like, food deserts. So it's kind of delving into food and the cultivation of it and sustainability and, you know, foodies and how we've gotten to be such a food-crazy culture. Mm-hmm. But I know there's a lot of foodies out there that this will appeal to. we have an interesting fictional narrative called Far West, which is from France. And it's kind of Fargo meets the Kardashians, something like that. but I think people really enjoy it. It's a, you know, it's one of those, you know, family of secrets, and as they're uncovered, and you won't believe what happens next, and, you know, and it's in French, with, of course, with English subtitles, so you'll certainly understand what's going on.
But Fargo meets the Kardashians. That's, I think you might have sold me on that. That is so intriguing.
Well, I mean, you know, imagine the Kardashians with the craziness, but not as pretty.
All right.
But, you know, it's got the esoteric of being French, so that alone makes up for the lack of glamour. we have some that I really have kind of an interesting local kind of appeal. Mm-hmm. This film called When Mickey Came to Town. I don't know if you remember this, but several years ago, Walt Disney decided that they were going to put a theme park in rural Virginia, like rural Northern Virginia, Loudoun County.
No way. I don't remember this. Yeah.
It was a big controversy at the time. But the interesting thing is that the people of that area kind of organized themselves and fought back and said, we don't want it. You know, it was going to be, the focus was going to be on history. So they were kind of like going to Disneyfy history in a place where real history happened. And, you know, the citizens decided, you know, hey, Disney, you know, we don't care if you're a really powerful corporation. This is our home, and we don't want a fake history theme park. And Disney was forced to pull back.
Wow.
So I like it because it is local, but it's also the story. It's kind of a David and Goliath story. You know, people can go up against something that's very powerful and wealthy and still win.
Yeah, most definitely. So, Patty, can you tell me one thing? I know with the film festival, because it has it's local, it's in Alexandria. You guys are going to different places. I love the fact that you can go to the Beatley Library and you can just watch a bunch of movies for free, which I tend to always check out. And then you can also go to AMC Hoffman and check out these great showcases. Could you talk a little bit about that local angle that you all have and how you enrich the community? Because I think that's one of the big things with film festivals. When you come into the area, we're all enriched from it culturally, but then also, you know, people have to eat. So businesses, you know, are able to have people come in their doors. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, you know, our mission is to make Alexandria a place that is appealing to filmmakers and also a place where this content, rich content, can be provided. So what we like to have, you know, both sides of that coin. We have many local filmmakers that have been in the film festival, you know, several times. I mean, we have a really cute film by a local young student filmmaker that was Burke and Herbert's entry to the American Banker Association video contest. And it was called Lights, Camera, Save. And these kids were challenged to make a film about saving. Hmm. And the kid from Alexandria won second prize.
Oh, wow.
So it's called A Squirrel's Guide to Saving. And it's just adorable. And I think people will really enjoy it. I mean, that's part of a larger. So we have, you know, young filmmakers. We have local filmmakers. And then we have, you know, films and filmmakers coming from Spain, Sweden, South America, Colombia. So, you know, we also feature films from around the world. And these are films you would not ever see unless you had gone to a film festival where one of them was playing. Really excellent films that are, you know, you're just never going to see at the local Cineplex.
Yeah, most definitely. And you're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with the chair of the Alexandria Film Festival, Patty North. Patty, as we kind of wrap out here, 10th anniversary, you know, what does that mean to you? That's a big thing. We're going to be doing a big celebration, obviously, but 10 years.
Yeah. Well, that's even more remarkable when you know industry research has shown that only 2.4% of filmmakers last 10 years.
Wow.
So we're in pretty, you know, rarefied company there.
Yeah.
Something like only a quarter make it to 6 years. So, you know, I base that on sort of three or four components. One is the support of the community, you know, the people who come, people who buy the tickets. Our sponsors who support us. You know, we couldn't do this without money, and we raised that money ourselves. And we have very generous sponsors. Alexandria Hyundai has supported us for all 10 years.
Wow.
So we're really grateful, you know, for that. And also our volunteers. You know, everybody on my executive committee, all volunteers. We have a network of 100 volunteers in the community who judge films, who take tickets, who, you know, help people find the right theater. So, you know, to make all that happen for even 1 year is something. 10 years, gotta admit, pretty proud of that.
Yeah, as you should be. I'm hoping that maybe for the 10-year anniversary, Hyundai decides they want to give away a free car to a certain radio host.
Well, you know, you're welcome to suggest that to them.
Right. But, okay. Well, Patty, you hit it earlier, but how can people find out more information and buy tickets?
Well, if they go to our website, alexfilmfest.com, they will find the entire schedule and a link to Eventbrite, which is where you would purchase tickets. And tickets in advance are $12 and $15 at the door. And you can get an all-fest pass for the amazing price of $50 in advance and $60 at the door.
Wow, that's actually a pretty good deal, folks. So you definitely want to take advantage of it. November 10th through the 13th, the Alexandria Film Festival. Patty North, thanks so much for coming on Picture Lock.
Thank you, Kevin. Enjoyed it.
Let's take a quick break for promos. Stay tuned. For you, the listeners of Picture Lock's podcast, Gamefly is offering a premium free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. I used to play PlayStation a ton pre-kids. I had money to buy the latest game out, but I really don't have the time or money like I used to give towards my hobby. That's why Gamefly makes so much sense. For a low monthly fee, I can get the latest console and handheld game delivered to my door. I keep it as long as I want and can send it right back to get a new one. The cool thing is, if you like a game so much that you don't want to send it back, you can keep it for a low used price. There are never any due dates or late fees. To get your free trial today, go to gameflyoffer.com/picturelock. Again, that's gameflyoffer.com/picturelock for your free 30-day trial.
Hi, I'm Anthony Anderson, the writer, producer, and director of Anacostia, the web series, and you're listening to Picture Lock.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. You're hearing it here first, folks. A&E has a hit new docuseries on its hands. The Killing Season debuts Saturday, November 12th at 9 p.m. Eastern on A&E. Within the series, documentarians Josh Zeman and Rachel Mills set out to find answers to the Gilgo Beach serial killings of the 90s and 2000s that have never been solved. On the line with me, I have producer and director of the series, Josh Zeman. Josh, welcome to Picture Lock.
Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
It's my pleasure. All right, first question I always like to start out with is, when did you first fall in love with film?
Good question. I think I've always felt that I was interested in working in the film kind of since high school, I guess. And then from there, I went and started working on film sets when I was in college during my summers.
And you just got the bug, especially for documentary, correct?
Well, documentaries are an interesting thing. I think back when I was starting, I don't think anybody really kind of felt the way about documentaries that they do now. You know, documentaries have gone through a kind of renaissance in the past couple of years, and that's been very exciting. It may not look like it, but documentaries is really kind of like filmmaking without a net. You know, you don't have a script, and you really just kind of have to go where the story takes you. And a lot of documentaries are created in the edit room. You know, that's where stories evolve, stories change. Believe it or not, sometimes some people walk into the edit room with one idea of the film they want to make, and something else happens.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I always feel like whenever it's been a minute since I've shot a doc, but when I had the idea, it's like, this is the idea I want to shoot. You get out there, you start shooting it, and then you start to see there's a totally different story. And then, like you said, when you get to the cutting room floor, it could even morph into something else.
Yeah. And that's cool and scary.
All right. So you first started out doing the documentaries Cropsey and Killer Legend. Can you tell the audience what those docs were about and then how they prepared you for the Killing Season?
Good one. So Cropsey was about, one of the first things I always like to tell people is that it's always good to start when making anything, writing documentaries, narrative films, write what you know. You know, make a movie about what you know, your hometown.
Right.
And, you know, it's really interesting. For me, this was a case that happened in my hometown. I remember it as a kid. And basically, it's about an urban legend come true in my hometown of Staten Island, New York. There was always, in the middle of Staten Island, there was this abandoned mental institution called Cropsey. Sorry, there was this abandoned mental institution called Willowbrook. And as kids, we would go there and we would hang out and have keg parties and stuff like that. But there was always an urban legend about an escaped mental patient who would snatch children. And we really didn't think anything of it until kids started disappearing on Staten Island. And it happened with this one little girl named Jennifer Schweiger. She disappeared from the neighborhood and they found her body buried on the grounds of that same mental institution that we would go to as kids. So suddenly this urban legend became real. And then we went in and we looked at the story and we realized that the kind of police and some of the families knew that there was this kind of killer pedophile in Staten Island. They could never arrest him because they could never find the bodies, but they told the kids this urban legend, or they told the kids this warning, and this warning then turned into urban legend. And so the film uses it, one of the trials as the backdrop, to talk about how a community interprets fear from within. And so that's Cropsey. And then off that, people were very interested in the idea of this intersection between true crime and urban legends. Urban legends typically have some sort of true crime that is associated with them. That kind of, what we say, makes the story sticky. You know, it allows the urban legend to feel real. Mm-hmm. And so we went and looked at a lot of kind of famous urban legends. For example, one that's happening right now, which is the clown thing. Like, back in the 1980s, there were a number of phantom clown scares in Boston, in Chicago, in Pittsburgh, in Arizona, in Scotland. But what happened back then is a little different from what's happening now. Back then, kids were seeing clowns in a white van driving around and kind of snatching kids. And it was hysteria. You know, there really were no kids and there were no clowns driving around in white vans. You know, it was just this hysteria that went from city to city to city in a pre-internet age, which is what we found so interesting. Mm-hmm. Today, that's come back again. I think the idea of the evil clown has entered into our collective consciousness. It's become, now when we talk about clowns are always evil. They're never, you know, kind of nice, fun characters that we used to see, like Bozo the Clown.
Right.
So now, however, you really do have a lot of people going up and dressing up and kind of discussing that.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with the producer-director of A&E's new docuseries, The Killing Season, Josh Zeman. Josh, if you could, in your own words, what is The Killing Season about?
So basically, off-cropsy, everybody was asking me, you know, are you going to do another serial killer doc? Are you going to do another serial killer doc? And I really didn't want to. Dealing with families who have missing children, you very quickly realize that the truth is much more frightening than you could ever imagine. It has, you know, I kept turning on the TV and seeing all these serial killer shows, and they weren't really getting to the truth. And so I kind of shied away from the serial killer stuff for a little while. And then this case happened in Long Island. And basically what happened is in 2010, a girl goes missing. She's an escort. And there's some strange circumstances about her disappearing. She's running from this house in this enclave in Long Island. Nobody can find her. They don't know what happened to her. And the police start kind of looking around. And about a mile away, they found the remains of four other escorts on this desolate highway. Nobody knows who did it. A couple months later, they find the remains of six more sex workers along this desolate highway. And so it was just amazing. In Long Island, which is basically kind of like in our backyard of New York City, and I'm originally from Long Island, I was born there, suddenly you have 10 bodies. And it's like, obviously points to a serial killer. But I still wasn't really interested in doing it just yet. You know, I figured with so many bodies, the case would be quickly solved. But then you're number one, and there's no arrest. Year number two, there's no arrest. And then it starts to come out that the police are refusing to talk to the community about what's going on. There's allegations of political backstabbing and all these other interesting things going on. And it looked like these women weren't going to get any justice. And so we started to pick up our camera, you know, go out on the weekends, film an interview here, film an interview there. And what we realized is this became a great opportunity for us, my partner Rachel and I, to show the truth behind serial murder. Like, it's not like Hannibal. You know, there's not some wickedly evil genius, you know, who's concocting these crimes. And it's not like, you know, The Fall, where the serial killer is really good looking and there's a female, you know, investigator. It's nothing like that. And in fact, the truth of what we found is more frightening than TV could ever create.
Wow. With documentaries, and you kind of touched on this just a second ago, gaining the trust of your subject is huge, especially when you're dealing with the families of murder victims.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us how and why it's important? Because I think in watching the part of The Killing Season that I've seen, I feel like you really gain the trust of those that are on there. And it's like you're on their side trying to seek justice.
You know, it's really hard. Whether it's Cropsey or The Killing Season, you know, you have to go in with the best of intentions. You have to go in saying, listen, you know, a lot of these women have been on shows like Nancy Grace. You know, they go on for five minutes and you know, Nancy Grace screams about a serial killer. What's happening? And
right.
Then, you know, they're done. You know, and these parents, they feel kind of, you know, used and spit out. And so we went back to them and they were like, no, we don't want to talk about this case anymore. We're like, listen, we're going to do a real investigation. And plus there's a lot of them are upset about the politics of what's going on. A lot of them are upset because they think that there's prejudice against, you know, their daughters or their sisters because they were sex workers. A lot of them feel like the media just does a very cursory pass, you know, just kind of like, it's like victim porn, you know? And so we had to go in there and say, listen, we're in for the long haul. And and that's what it takes with your subjects. It's not a couple months, it's 4 years, you know? And that's what I think audiences and your audience really needs to understand. Like you have a responsibility. You can't just go in there and be like, oh, this is going to be like a month or two. Like, you have to consistently fight, and you have to fight to, you know, when they go low, you go high, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's true because there's, you know, in the world of true crime, I mean, look, you can see it on this. There's a People magazine show on Discovery ID, which is coming out the same week we do. And they show like reenactments of like women screaming into the phone and bodies being kind of thrown on the ground. And that's not right. That's not how, you know, you should be treating these women and these cases. You know, that's, you know, victim porn. You know, you have to be the better person, and you have to really get into the story of who's responsible. And what we found is it's not just the killer in these cases. It's a set of circumstances that allows these killers to do what they do. You know, it's police that aren't paying attention. It's prejudice against sex work. It's the internet where these women are going on Backpage and thinking that somehow it's going to be safer when in fact it's more anonymous and it's even more, you know, it's less safe. So that's your responsibility. That's what you have to bring to the table. And every time someone tries to kind of like, you know, schlock it up, you got to fight not to.
Yeah, you know, and I really appreciated that about the first episode that I watched. I really felt as though you all actually tried to not be in the documentary. And I noticed that you specifically like cut yourself out. The only time that you're actually on the screen is when like you're actually investigating and you're asking a question, and it makes sense. Otherwise, it felt as though you tried to remove yourself, which I really appreciate because I know some people like to put themselves in their documentaries. We won't name names. But one of the questions I did have is it hard for you to not take this work home with you? I mean, I this is obviously people's lives. And so how do you live with these stories?
You know, it wasn't just Long Island. We go all over the country. I spent many nights at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning out talking to a sex worker on the street. And like, you see the light go out, you know, behind their eyes. Like, you know, oh, this girl is, you know, she may not be here in 6 months, you know, and whether that's the addiction issues, the opiate epidemic that's ruining this country, or it's the fact that, you know, she's going to become a victim of violence. And it, you know, obviously it's not just, you know, hardcore serial killers who are murdering these women. It's just regular people, you know? And so, you know, you realize that, you know, you're staring death in the face a lot. That is heavy, but look, you know, you got to fight. You got to fight for these women, and, you know, you got to fight in a way where you're not like, where you're not preachy. You got to fight in a way where you're just like doing the work, you know, and you do bring it home with you. But at the same time, I think, you know, we really try to give these women a voice, and you always have to have that understanding that you never know. Like, if I can make somebody care, maybe they'll call, maybe they'll say something, maybe they'll do something. And that's what you have to, you know, keep forward and moving with.
Most definitely. You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with producer and director of A&E's new docuseries, The Killing Season, Josh Zeman. Josh, it's kind of apples to oranges, but this does remind me of Making a Murderer in the sense that you want to just keep watching. Can you tell us how you structured the season? Because I feel like by the end of it, like, I'm like, man, and I feel bad for folks at home that have to wait each week for it to come back, because it's one of those things where I'm like, nah, let's go to the next one. Let's go to the next one. Like, it's like Law and Order SVU or something, you know, like you could just keep watching. How did you structure the season? How did you come up with that?
Good question. You know, and this is important. I originally started just thinking I was going to make a documentary about this one case, the Long Island serial killer. And suddenly we realized we had enough for more than that. And, you know, and then we put a sizzle together, you know, which is like 10 minutes of footage, you know, that feels like a really kind of extended trailer. And then we pitched it around. And, you know, what we try to do a little bit different in this thing is Making of a Murderer is about one case.
Right.
And what we wanted to do was show, you know, an American nightmare, something that went beyond. And the way we were able to do that is when we were in the Long Island case, people kept saying, you know, you should probably look at this other case in Atlantic City that happened a couple months before, which was also for sex workers. And another person said, you know, you should probably look at this other case in Daytona, because there's some strange similarities, eerie similarities between the two. And so, I think, you know, we originally concentrated on the Long Island case for a couple episodes, and then we were able to kind of, you know, look at these other cases and make it feel, because it really was, like maybe this killer was, you know, moving from city to city, you know, and that's what we tried to investigate. And then at the end, it was amazing. If you watch the end, we had no idea what was going to happen. If you see the end, you're going to be like, oh my God, with regards to Long Island. So that was luck. Some of it was structure. Some of it was luck, you know.
Some of
it was just going where the story takes you, you know.
Yeah. All right. So kind of coming to the end of the interview here, cinematography and the score are intricate to the part of the show. I mean, it's a dark subject. The show is kind of darkly lit and the score is haunting. Who is your cinematographer? Like, who produced the score? Can you talk about how you guys put that together?
I mean, look, the look was really, really important for the film. We wanted this feeling like you were out there on the street.
Yep.
You know, and, you know, they required a lot of night shooting. You know, we wanted to feel a little bit like this is what it's like driving down the highway with a sex worker in the car. You know, it's cell phones and, you know, headlights and a lot of that type of stuff. My cinematographer is Nelson Hume. He is amazing. The one thing that people were always saying when we were showing it to the network, they're like, wow, this looks creepy and good, you know? And so that was exciting. And then that composer is a guy by the name of Alex Lazarenko. And that's one thing, you know, TV doesn't get a lot of scored music for TV, meaning like they pull what's called needle drop music, which is basically like a bunch of tracks that are all creepy and you can use all these tracks and it costs a certain amount of money. But when you have like a movie or you have a documentary, you try and compose music so that there's themes that continue to return throughout the film. And it feels like parts of a whole, you know, it's like an outfit, you know, you can just wear a pair of pants and a shirt and a jacket, or you can like coordinate it all.
Right.
You know, and that's what composing is a little bit like, making sure all the music kind of is playing in the right themes and the right colors and the whole nine yards. And so Alex Lazarenko, who I worked with on Cropsey and Kill the Legends, did this as well, and I think he did a wonderful job. Both the composition and the cinematography, in my eyes, are amazing, especially when you get into the later episodes. It's just incredible.
Yeah, most definitely. Well, I can't wait to see some more of it. How can people see The Killing Season?
They can tune in on November 12th to A&E, and that's where they can see the episodes.
All right, Josh. Well, again, I think you just have a hit on your hands. I'm calling it. You hear it here first from Picture Lock, Kevin Sampson. Like I said, the reason I believe that is because of the care that I can tell that you took in telling the story, capturing the story, and you could really see it through the faces and the people that are are the family members of the victims. You know, they look like they've had a hard life. They have a life story behind them. But the trust that they had in you and the way that they were able, I mean, for the father, and once in the first season or first episode, the father said, you know, I hope I think it was his daughter. I think he said, I hope she got got a lick in on him or mm-hmm, whatever. Mm-hmm. And with that, he was talking about his daughter. He was saying that, you know, I obviously I loved her and she had that spark. She was a fighter. But then at the same time, the sad part is it's kind of like he's come to accept that she's gone. And so, you know, for just to get people to do that, I know that as a filmmaker myself, that takes a lot. So again, hats off. The Killing Season, A&E, November 12th. It's going to be amazing for us.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, everyone. This is Danielle Vega, a.k.a. Ceci of Hulu's original series, East Los High, and you are tuned in to Picture Lock.
Hey, everybody, this is filmmaker Joe Carabello. You are listening to the best show in the whole entire planet, Picture Lock. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, and the new documentary, The Eagle Huntress, follows Aisha Pan, a 13-year-old girl who trains to become the first female in 12 generations of her Kazakh family to become an eagle hunter and rises to the pinnacle of a tradition that has been handed down from father to son for centuries. The film just took home the Audience Choice Award at the Middleburg Film Festival and is destined for greatness. I have the director and subjects of the film, Otto Bell, Aishalpan, and Alkali, on the line with me. Guys, welcome to Picture Lock.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm delighted to have you. I just saw the film in Middleburg, and I was totally blown away. We'll definitely get into the film in a second, but the first question I always ask is, when did you first fall in love with film?
Oh, gosh. For me, it's always been something that's been with me. The magic of cinema. I really started to build a love affair, so I think back in about 2005, 2006, that's when I started producing and then ultimately directing sort of short form documentary work here in New York. But yeah, I'm interested to know that I don't think I've ever asked Aisha Pan or Regulator. When did you guys, does Aisha Pan remember the first film she ever saw?
Bugün bir Allah söz konusunu yüzünü görmedik. Bir Allah söz konusunu çarpıştı içine dönmüştü.
Do you, Agalai? Do you remember the first film you ever
saw? Bugün bir Allah söz konusunu
Yeah, there's not much in the way of cinemas or anything like that where they live.
Right, I would assume. All right. So if you could tell the listeners, Otto, in your own words, what's the film about?
It's a film about Aisha Pan, a 13-year-old nomad living in the Altai Mountains of northwest Mongolia, so the most remote corner of the least populated country in the world. And it's about her pursuing her dream, her ambition of becoming one of the first women to hunt with a golden eagle, which is an ancient practice. It's hundreds, if not thousands, of years old. And traditionally, you know, there are exceptions, but traditionally it's mostly been a pastime pursued by men. And, you know, Aisha Pan doesn't see a reason why she can't take up this tradition as well. And a father and a mother, well, the whole sort of immediate family are very supportive of that. And she goes on to be a very successful young eagle huntress. So ultimately, it's really, you know, there is a female empowerment angle to it. But ultimately, it's just a story about a dad and his daughter. So it's quite exotic. It's set in a very foreign land. It features customs and traditions and costumes that seem very unfamiliar. But it does have a lot of universal themes, you know, a lot of stories about family and so on that, you know, we can all understand and appreciate.
Yeah, most definitely. And that was one of the things that I definitely want to get into that really touched me the most. Right now, you're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, and I'm talking with the director and subjects of the new documentary, The Eagle Huntress, Otto Bell, Aishalpan, and Alkali. Otto, when did you find out about Aishalpan, and when did you decide that you wanted to make a documentary about this?
Oh, gosh, I first found out about Aishalpan through a photo essay on BBC.com. They were photographs, incredibly beautiful photographs, taken by a young Israeli photographer called Asher Svidinsky. And he had stumbled across Ashurpan in the Altai Mountains, training with her father's eagle. And he had taken this beautiful photo essay that I was just so profoundly moved by. And I found Asher through Facebook, and we had a conversation. And very quickly, he and I were on a plane to Mongolia to meet the family and to talk to them about making a film.
So, for the family, you know, what was that like, having someone to come to your home and say, hey, we want to make a film about you?
He didn't come straight there, because before he could come, Otto was speaking to the family through the other people, and they were expecting Otto that he would come. And also, not only Otto, even before that, they were having many tourist guests with the cameras. So they were thinking that it will be something similar to other tourists.
All right. And then one of the things, I think there's a moment in the film that really I teared up on. And it's after the hunting festival has ended, or the Eagle Festival has ended. And Aishulpan and her father are in the tent. And as her father talks about how well she did, Aishulpan looks at him and smiles. And for me, as a father of a little girl, I know that look. And I think in that moment, she was proud of her father. And at the same time, I think she realized that her father was saying, hey, my daughter can do anything. And that, to me, just melted my heart. So for the family, once again, just in terms of your relationship, because I think, Otto, you definitely captured that well. I wanted to ask Aishulpan herself, what does your father mean to you? And then for Alkali, what does your daughter mean to you?
First thing that she likes from her father is that her father believes in her. It makes her believe herself. So he likes it from Aishulpan that Aishulpan does really accurate with eagles and with every outwork, with horse riding and with any activities that he has been doing at his childhood. So it also pushed him to understand that she a little bit follows her father. So yeah, what he likes most from the Aishulpan is that Aishulpan is not like the other girls. She doesn't feel herself weak. She just goes and does it.
Perfect. All right, so Otto, one of the things that I thought about this film is that it is definitely a film that could only be made now, and I hate to dive into how did you shoot it questions, but I really think that that's what helps the film to stand out. As I watched it, you could have told me it was a narrative film, and I'd have believed it, but the drone footage really helped to accentuate the harsh landscape. So could you just talk a little bit about how you shot this and especially that drone footage, because it was so beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think it's today's technology that allowed us to make this film. And look, it's even the technology that we used is even outdated at this point, I'm afraid to say, because things are moving so quickly. But you're right. We made this film with three people and my life savings. So we didn't have much of a budget and we didn't have a big crew. But what we did have was a lot of technology on our side. For example, we took an S-1000 drone, an octocopter, which gave us some really beautiful 4K aerials, which, you know, the landscape out there is so vast and so cinematic, we really wanted to do that justice. So that drone really helped us open up the landscape and gave us a big kind of epic feel that we knew that we really wanted to do justice to that landscape. And then my cameraman, Simon Niblett, he's amazing. He's a bit of an inventor. He created a 9-meter crane for me that folds away into a snowboard bag. And it weighs like 25 kilos. And that, again, that helps us with these kind of sweeping crane shots.
Yeah.
That make this feel cinematic and make Ashulpan, I think, make it feel like a heroine, you know? My feeling was, look, just because we've stumbled across an incredibly amazing and wonderful true story, I also wanted it to be beautiful. You know, I thought it can, just because it's true doesn't mean that it can't also be beautiful. Because I found her quite beautiful, I found the story quite beautiful, and I wanted it to look beautiful as well. And, you know, we worked very hard at that, at getting that kind of very polished look. And it's credit also to my editor, Pierre, as well, because this is my first film. So the rushes that I brought back were in a hell of a state. And these good 9 months sort of smoothing it out and really making it feel seamless. But he did a great job on getting it to the sort of the cinematic point it's at now.
Right. You know, Otto, as a documentarian, I think getting the family to trust you and ethically capturing what's going on is a serious thing. And watching the film, I believe you really achieved this. What was it like being with the family and in terms of them bringing you in and obviously trusting you to be right there in the midst of everything?
Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. Yeah, I mean, you know, every day wasn't a bowl of roses. You know, like any family, you have your ups and downs, but I think we're all very proud. Well, I know we're all very proud of the finished product, and you know, we're like family now. So it's been lovely. It's been a genuinely kind of additive experience for me, and I hope for them as well. You know, we made a lot of memories together, and there's that sense of responsibility as well. You know, when I first filmed climbing down the mountainside and taking the eaglet out of the nest, I realized that this was quite a special story, and it, almost immediately it sort of became bigger than my ambitions or the film that I wanted to make, and it very much became a sort of a responsibility to the family to make sure that we did the best possible job of telling this incredible young girl's story, you know, for other girls and boys.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, and I'm talking to the director and subject of the new documentary, The Eagle Huntress, Otto Bell, Ashulpan, and her father, Alkali. As we wrap out, guys, this is a question for everyone. What's been your favorite part of the whole experience, and especially for Ashulpan, now that you see yourself on the big screen, what does that feel like?
Well, yeah. From the film, when she sees herself, she always loves to see how she is taking her eagle from the nest. That part is her favorite part. And while they are making the movie, she found most interesting and more funny. Funny part is also that they part taking the eagle from the nest, but also she enjoyed all the making moments, how she was riding on the mountain, how she was just going on the mountain with hunting. So everything that was happening there, she found very interesting and funny.
I think this movie was incredible. I could geek out on it so much. I wish we had more time to actually do that, because you know, just even the narrative structure. It was harrowing just seeing them go after the eaglet, and I'm like, oh man, how do you get bigger from that than the Eagle Hunter Festival, and then actually going hunting and catching the fox? I mean, this is an amazing film. Otto, how can people see the film now?
The film, I'm happy to say, is going to be out in New York and LA on the 2nd of November, and then it's going to roll out from there. It should be everywhere across the country by Thanksgiving.
Awesome. Otto Bell, Aishalpan, and Alkali, thanks so much for coming on Picture Lock. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Otto, again, let me just say, hats off. This is an amazing documentary. It's so special. I could geek out on this. Seriously. I mean, at the end of the day, it's really not about the amazing landscape and the harrowing cinematography and all that stuff. It really is about this intimate relationship between a family, and you captured that. Hats off to everybody involved. Great job, great work. That's all for this episode. I'd like to thank my guests, Patty North, Josh Zeman, Otto Bell, Aishalpan, and Alkali for coming on the show. You can find Picture Lock on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Periscope. All social media is at Picture Lock Show. Watch back episodes of the TV show at youtube.com/picturelockshow. Be sure to subscribe over there. You can download the podcast in iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Google Play Music, and other places podcasts are downloaded. Feel free to give the show a hearty review if you're enjoying it. Don't forget to check out the website, picturelockshow.com, for movie reviews, news, and to subscribe to our newsletter to get a chance to win tickets for movie screenings in the DMV. If you're interested in being a guest on the show, you can fill out the form on the website. And drop me a line if you're enjoying the show as well at picturelockshow@gmail.com. Got to give a big shout out to Devin Wheeler, editing the interviews on this episode of the podcast. Thank you, sir. All music is done by Mike S., the Prophet 13. Thanks, bro. I'm Kevin Sampson, and until next time, I hope you stay locked on film. Ride sharing is all the rave these days. Wherever you're headed, count on Lyft for rides and minutes. Whether you're riding solo or with friends, with Lyft, you've got options. Get picked up by one of their drivers who will get you where you need to go. When the ride ends, just pay and rate your driver through your phone. It's quick, it's easy, and just a couple taps away. Visit Lyft.com for more details. And if you haven't tried Lyft yet, but want to give it a whirl with a $50 ride credit, sign up at Lyft.com/invited/picturelockshow. That's right. If you're a new member to Lyft and in an eligible market, you can get a $50 ride credit with Picture Lock. Again, that's Lyft.com/invited/picturelockshow for a free $50 ride credit.